Winter thrills await at Winterfest at Nemacolin. Join the fun on Saturday, February 10th for a day of fun-fueled winter festivities like skiing and snowboarding, snow tubing, ice skating, and snow bikes. You'll be able to meet the Nemacolin Dog Sled Team, try your hand at ice bowling, compete in the out-cold race, and finish your day with a brew by the fire at the peak. A winter of wonders waiting for you at Nemacolin's Winterfest. Experiences are for overnight guests and members. For more information, visit nemacolin.com.
You're listening to the Quince Podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Nishtha Gautam and I'm the opinions editor at the Quint. And today I have a very, very special offering by way of an interview with an extremely special guest. Without further ado, let me introduce him. I am joined today by Mr. Amitav Ghosh, celebrated Indian author, also a Gyanpeeth awardee, who is ready with his new book at the stalls. And the book is already getting rave reviews because it talks about the way we live now and how it has changed over many centuries. The book is called The Nutmeg's Curse, and it talks about climate change, history of colonialism, and how society has changed over a period of time. So let's get this conversation rolling. Many congratulations, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Nishtha.
And it's always a delight to await a new book that Amitav Ghosh is writing. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who gets excited every time there is an announcement.
That's so sweet of you. Thank you. That's really sweet.
Since I have been following you over, since I studied Shadow Lines as part of my curriculum as a student of English Honours, and having read everything that you've ever written.
Oh my goodness, really?
Yes. There is a clear shift, and it is quite palpable. From Amitav Ghosh, the weaver of tales of history of people, to Amitav Ghosh, who is almost straddling the world of climate activism in his own manner, I must add.
Do you
get to hear that often?
I think certainly there's been a huge sort of, what you would expect. I mean, people change over the years as you grow older. But far more than that, I would say that really, that it's not me changing. It's the planet changing, that has made this happen to me. Because, I was going along just fine. But now, as you can see, all these things are just happening around the world. And they force themselves on your attention. You can't escape them, The world we live in today is not the world we lived in when I wrote The Shadow Lines. It's a completely changed, the planet itself has changed.
When did you first realize that things were not as they used to be around you?
Well, there were two things, I suppose, because it's not just climate change that has changed the world. There's been a deep and fundamental shift in global politics and geopolitics even, So there were two things, I imagine. One, of course, was that in 2000, I went to the Sundarbans, in connection with my research for The Hungry Tide. And in the Sundarbans, the effects of climate change are sort of ever present. You could see them quite clearly, saltwater intrusion, the changes in species, all of this was very much visible there. So, that was when I started to take this whole issue of climate change seriously, The second thing I would say was at 9/11. I was in New York the day it happened. And, you know, so on the one hand, you have the change in the natural phenomena on the planet. And on the other hand, you have this dramatic sort of development in the politics and geopolitics of the planet. So both were, you know, profound shocks, I would say.
Right. And they almost happened around the same time, because if, correct me if I'm wrong, Hungary tide came in the early part of 2004-5?
It came out in 2004, in fact, and just just before the great tsunami, you know, that was also something which had a profound impact, you know, I think on many of us, but certainly it did on me, because, you know, Hungry Tide ends with that great storm surge, a great wave, which, you know, they barely survived. You know, then the tsunami happened just shortly after that. And a lot of people, you know, wrote to me at the time saying, oh my God, it's just uncanny that these things, what's happened is so similar to what you describe in the book.
Exactly. And I was actually going to come to that, because I remember the conversation around the book at that point in time. And a similar conversation, I think, should happen around your last book, Gun Island, because you're talking about flooding of European cities, Italy in particular. And we have seen terrible scenes from across Europe, where rainfall has just wreaked havoc in most of these cities that never expected to be flooded.
You're absolutely right. Well, first about Gun Island, you know, in Gun Island, some of the things that happen in that have been happening these last few years are again so uncanny. Because, you know, in Gun Island, I wrote about a fire approaching the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. And that actually happened. But it happened like 6 months after I wrote that chapter. So, you know, it was so strange and so disturbing in a way to see something that you'd been thinking about in your head suddenly play out in real life. So that was a very strange thing. But also, as a you know, exactly as you say, what's happening in Europe is also really startling, you know. You must have seen this footage from these recent floods in Germany, you know, in an area that's always been very tranquil. And then suddenly you have this incredible flash flood, you know, just going through this town and taking away, you know, these houses and buildings which have been there for centuries. Suddenly just sweeping them away.
Right.
And I saw an interview with a woman whose house had been swept away, and she was in shock, and she was saying, you know, we never expect these things to happen in Germany. We expect them to happen somewhere else. And, you know, that's really the strange thing, that there is nowhere else now. This
exactly.
is everywhere. It's happening
exactly.
all around us. Yeah.
However, you know, the latest book, you know, when I was reading it, it also seemed like a very harsh indictment of this development politics. And I'm not talking about politics which is restricted only to nation states. It's a global politics, really. So,
yeah.
Colonialism had development at the, you know, at least as an ostentatious reason to go and conquer these lands, which are wild and savage and whatnot. So the white man's burden had to be carried.
Yes, that's right.
And now we see these parallels in the, you know, in the contemporary times, in our own times, where again, a development politics of a different kind is making matters worse. It's almost accelerating the speed of decimation of this planet.
That is absolutely right. I mean, actually, that's really a very large part of the problem. You know, the impacts that are occurring in particular places are not just climate change impacts. They're also impact in anthropogenic impacts. You just take the case of these terrible floods in Chennai or Mumbai, you know. In Chennai, you know, when you have these floods, it's largely because, channels, drainage channels have been built over. River channels have been built over, have been constrained in so many ways. The same is true in Mumbai. So, you know, exactly what one of the major problems is, in fact, this kind of misplaced model of development, where you think you can just hold back rivers, where you can hold back the natural flow of water. But as they always say, you know, it's nature bats last. Mm-hmm. And that's really the thing. I mean, that's what we are seeing now. It's like nature has suddenly decided that enough already, you know, it's going to strike back.
But what has actually not changed is the fact that wealthy nations or wealthy individuals can shrug their responsibilities very easily and say, oh, you are the poor one, you are the one who's using a chulha instead of clean energy, or you are the one who's driving a tractor which runs on diesel. So you should be the one taking steps, while, you know, I'm driving my Tesla. So I have already done my bit to, you know, to keep this planet safe. How do you feel about this sort of phony concern for climate change and environment? Whereas you as in the wealthy nations or wealthy individuals have been the originator, as it were, of the problem.
It's completely a case of blaming the victim. You know, that is what it is. They're blaming the victims. This is exactly, you're absolutely right that, you know, there is this kind of greenwashing whereby, you know, someone will buy a Tesla and say that it shrinks their carbon footprint. But it's complete nonsense. You know, the Tesla, the embodied emissions in producing a Tesla are enormous. The battery that's in the Tesla, you know, what does it use? It has a huge footprint, not just in terms of carbon, but also in terms of rare earths and minerals and so on. I mean, anyone who has ever been in a Tesla will know that, you know, saving energy is the last thing on the mind of the designers of a Tesla. You know, I mean, even the doors use energy to open. So, yeah, I think this is what has actually happened. In fact, I mean, you know, in developed countries, in the rich world, and amongst rich people in Asia, there's this enormous kind of greenwashing that is underway. You know, a sort of pretense of doing something for the environment.
Can we be a little provocative and ask you, who do you think is the biggest culprit? Would you say the United States or Europe?
The biggest culprit, in most senses, is, in fact, is the United Kingdom. You know, even though it has a very small, comparatively a population that's small in relation to India and China, the United Kingdom is very high up on the list of countries that are responsible for historic emissions. You know. This is the thing we have to keep in mind always, you know, that greenhouse gases have a very long life. It's not like, you know, you pour some dirt in a river and then take the dirt out. I mean, that can be done, but greenhouse gases can't be taken out of the environment in that day. So what the United Kingdom was doing in the 19th century is still with us. You know, those are historic emissions. So the United Kingdom led the way both in inventing the technology for which they long patted themselves on their back and said, oh, we are so brilliant. We came up with, you know, all this industrial machinery. And now we are paying the price of all this. You know, the whole world is paying the price of all this. Vulnerable people, especially around the world. So the United Kingdom is very high up on the list of historic emissions. The United States is actually at the top of the list of historic emissions. And there can be no doubt that they have an enormous responsibility for all of this. And that responsibility is ongoing, you know. But So too does Russia. Russia has huge historic emissions. So does Germany, and so on. So basically, it's the countries that industrialized first and that grew rich first that bear most of the responsibility. This is not to exonerate China or India or Indonesia. We also bear a responsibility to this day. But I think the way to think about this is exactly the terms that were laid out by Sunita Narayan and Anil Agarwal in their pamphlet a long, long time ago. It's the seminal contribution, where they basically talk about common but differentiated responsibility. So, I mean, China to this day, even though it's the world now the in gross terms the world's largest polluter, in per capita terms, their emissions are a fraction of those of countries that are like the United States. India's per capita emissions are even smaller. But again, we have to remember that middle class and wealthy Indians, their carbon footprint is just as big as that of Americans or Saudis for that matter.
Right. Let me be a little provocative here and ask you, do you by assigning and ascribing blame to nations that adopted technology early on and then thus share the blame for changing the planet, do you feel that you could be mistaken for being anti-technology? Or anti-science by extension.
Look, the whole history of technology is one of disastrous unintended consequences. We see this constantly. So for a long time, it was thought that building giant dams, for example, was a great thing. Now, across the United States, they're actually dismantling dams because keeping up those dams has proved to be unsustainable. Similarly, let's just take individual examples. Let's take the water pump, especially fossil fuel powered water pumps, which we have in India, and which has also been very important in American agriculture. So what has the fossil fuel powered water pump led to, in India, for example? What it led to is farmers just started neglecting overland irrigation and started concentrating on, just pumping up huge amounts of water with subsidized electricity. So now, the unintended consequence is that the Upper Ganga aquifer, on which 300 million people depend for their life, for their sustenance and livelihood, stretching from northern India into Pakistan. Now the Upper Ganga aquifer is almost depleted. So, at the time, it seemed like this was a great technological blessing, this water pump. Now we see it was a disaster. It's created conditions for a disaster. So this is often the case, with certain kinds of technological innovations, that they seem wonderful at the time. Oh, you have a brand new toy, something is great, and so on. But over time, you see that it leads to this kind of absolute disaster. The same has happened in the United States. The entire Great Plains region of the United States, which historically was semi-arid. You couldn't really grow much in the Great Plains, and I'm near the Great Plains right now. I'm sitting in Utah, but in the starting in the 1940s, again depending on these mechanical water pumps, especially gas-powered water pumps, they started pumping up enormous quantities of water from the Ogallala Aquifer. The Ogallala Aquifer is now again almost exhausted. So, something that seems wonderful at the time can actually prove to be disastrous in the long run. The British thought that making the great Upper Ganga canals and so on was a great idea, and at the time it seemed like a great idea. Now we see that the long-term environmental impacts of those canals are anything but benign, you know?
Right. Another thing, which is specific to the book here, you talk about the process of colonization, and you talked about Banda Islands and the Dutch settlement there.
Mm.
Something similar happened in Mumbai. You know, the way the islands were created artificially. You know, they were brought together, and it just, again, as you said, it seemed like a great idea back then. It isn't all that great at the moment. But where do you think that this foresight can come from? Because you only learn as you go along. Would anyone have thought that it would be disastrous then?
Yes, people had thought. That's why, our ancestors didn't build a big city over there. You know, because people knew that, the sea is not something that you play with, you know, that it's a dangerous thing. The reason that the British, even the Portuguese didn't build where Bombay is now, you know, they built on the mainland in Vasai, in what is now, what is now Vasai, what they called Bassein. And this was a very wise thing because, Vasai is not as vulnerable as the rest of Mumbai. But it was the British, who created, who came there, who thought, oh, we are so clever, we can do reclamation and so on. And they put, they joined these six islands together. And now we see that these six islands are actually slowly reverting back to the sea. The sea is what is reclaiming its own, you know. You know, if you look at the historic ports of India, none of them are cited in this way. You look at Cochin, you know, which is a very old port. Cochin is, in a very protected location. You look at Surat, which is a very old port. Again, it's a very protected location. All the inland ports of Bengal, they were very far inland. There was this terrible Fukushima disaster.
Yes.
You know. So in that very site, up the hillside, there are these stone markers, centuries old stone markers left behind by a medieval Japanese people. And what it says on the stone marker is, do not build below this line, because anything you build there is likely to be hit by a tsunami. So, the Japanese, the ancestors of today's Japanese had the foresight to understand this. But today's Japanese, what did they do? Not only did they build below that line, they built this giant nuclear plant, which is still leaking radioactivity into the ocean.
Right.
So, and it must have seemed like a great idea at the time,
Climate change and change in lifestyle and geopolitical changes, they have also brought about a very radical change to our food habits. And I want to talk about the lovely title of your book.
Mm.
The nutmeg is a beautiful spice, and you can't
now
think about so many fancy things without nutmeg. And one of them being the pumpkin spice latte, which is all the rage the world across. Mm.
Yeah.
Now, do you feel that the way we are eating and we are growing food, there is also some sort of culpability there too?
Yes, I think we are heading for a huge food production disaster, I mean, you look at the farmers, protests. Ultimately, large tracts of land in Punjab are becoming uncultivable. Again, we see here the unintended consequences of technology. It was thought to be a great idea at the time, but now as more and more research emerges, we see that it also created the groundwork for a disaster, because the Green Revolution depends hugely on technological input. Most of all, it depends on, pumping up water, using fossil fuel-based fertilizers and pesticides and so on. And that model is not sustainable in the long run. And that's really what is behind ultimately these enormous protests that we are seeing. I mean, essentially these farmers are losing their means of livelihood. This is going to be the case in the United States as well. Already we can see, can you imagine in California, the richest farmland are the vineyards, you know. Now, because of the wildfires, they can barely grow grapes anymore. This year they had to spray sunblock on the grapes because of the extreme heat. I mean, so, you know, these things may seem to be a huge a gift at a certain point, but the way that water is being used, the way that we're using all kinds of input, it's just completely unsustainable.
Right. My last question, sir, is are we going to see a return of Amitav Ghosh of the shadow lines, or do we see Amitav Ghosh of the Hungry Tide and Gun Island and other books, including The Nutmeg's Curse, coming out you know, as a full-fledged writer on climate issues in his own way?
Well, you know, the issues in The Nutmeg's Curse aren't just climate issues, because as Margaret Atwood says, you know, it's not just climate change, it's everything change. We're in the midst of a planetary crisis, you know, and it's sad to say, but when you've studied this thing in detail, you can see that things are really heading in a very, very bad direction, you know, and not just environmentally, but politically and in every possible way. We are going through an incredible destabilization of the world, you know, and we have to be aware of it. You know, Epicurus, the ancient philosopher, famously said, you never step in the same river twice, you know.
Yes, and, because you are a changed man the next time you come.
And the river is changed.
River is changed, yeah.
So no, you will never see the Amitav Ghosh of shadow lines again. This won't happen.
And do you think COP26, that is happening, is a step towards getting the river back, metaphorically speaking?
No, you know, already now you can see the huge roadblocks it's run into. Bolsonaro is now going to demand that Brazil be paid for preserving the Amazon. Can you imagine?
Yes.
So already we see these new kinds of roadblocks arising. In any case, Saudi Arabia has meddled with the language and already diluted the language that was being proposed. So, you know, from India, I think we can expect a lot of greenwashing, because we can see also the forests are being opened up to coal mines. So, you know, without being pessimistic, I think just being realistic, you know, I think this COP26 is going to be no better than any of the other earlier meetings, I'm sorry to say.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you. As I said, that the job of a storyteller is not to tell tales that please, but these are tales that need to be told, and time and again.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. For the sake of our children and grandchildren, we have to wake up, you know.
Thank you so
Lovely
much.
Lovely to talk to you, Nishtha. Thank you.
Thanks a
Thank
lot. You. Thanks for your time,
Thank
sir.
You. Thanks. Okay. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.